You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Hey, listen to this. Organic cane sugar, safflower oil, chamomile.
Sounds delicious. What is that a recipe for?
It's this super yummy face scrub.
What?
Right, from Voyage AC.
Okay.
It exfoliates your face and nourishes your skin.
I was going to say that your skin is glowing, honey. I think that scrub's definitely working.
Oh, thank you, hon. Mm-hmm. You'll want to check out all of Voyage AC's gorgeous face and body products, beautiful scents, and phenomenal candles. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find Voyage AC on our brand new website at theonlyonepod.com, or you can go to www.voyageac.com directly. That's VoyageTCIE.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now.
What?
Yep, that's 10% off everything you buy.
Right. All you need to do is enter The Only One at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter The Only One when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is the ultimate luxury blend of travel, design, and sense.
This podcast is supported by Cute Booty Lounge. And allow me to take a moment to thank Cute Booty Lounge for signing on to sponsor another season of The Only One in the Room.
Yay!
Yep, we love talking about them.
Yes, we do. And I love wearing them.
Mm-hmm.
Feel these, hon. Just run your hands up and down them.
Ooh, that's soft.
Right?
I don't know if I've ever said this before, though, but that is some sexy material.
Right? These lifestyle stretch booty leggings are some of the most comfortable leggings I've ever felt in my entire life. Mm. It's like you're wearing a soft cloud on your legs, and it comes with a matching crop top so you can be comfortable from head to toe. So let me just tell you a little bit about Cute Booty Lounge. They're made right here in the USA by women and for women.
Mm-hmm.
Company's incredible, female and minority owned. Everything they make makes your booty look amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Dresses, tops, lounge. Well, the tops make everything else look amazing. Lounge and sleepwear. And their leggings have these super cute patented scrunch butt pockets. I get stopped in them all the time. There is a cute booty style for everyone. Cute Booty Lounge has you covered. Embrace your body. Love your booty.
And to make the deal even sweeter, head over to cutebooty.com and enter the code TheOnlyBooty to get 15% off your first order.
That's such a great deal. What is it again, hon?
Yeah, get yours now. Head to cutebooty.com and enter the code TheOnlyBooty and get 15% off your first order.
Awesome.
Hi, I'm Rob Cabrera, and I'm the only one that survived the Rwandan genocide, spent 6 years refugee camps, and ended up on Forbes 30 Under 30 list. When you have hardships, you can either let those things frustrate you, or you can be grateful for every day because you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And when you do that and you don't take tomorrow for granted and you're very busy appreciating today, I can tell you now, the time in the camp in Botswana was some of the best days of my life because never once was tomorrow promised. It was a blessing to see the sunrise, it was a blessing to see the sunset. So in between, you made the most of it. The meaning of life is to discover your gift. The purpose of life is to give that gift away.
Picture this. You're 5 years old, and your mom is cooking dinner like she does every night. Suddenly, the air around your home is filled with screams and gunfire. Rob Cabrera, Stanford graduate, co-founder and COO of Sync Energy AI, survived the 1994 Rwandan genocide with his family by hiding in tunnels, evading soldiers, and spending 6 years in refugee camps. But what would you do if, after graduating from one of America's most prestigious universities, you discovered that 90% of Africa is not banked and that many of the people there were living off of the energy grid? Would you decide to ignore the problems of your home continent and focus on the USA? Or would you launch business after business aimed at helping people in various African countries and find yourself on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list in the energy sector? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. We are talking to Rob Cabrera today. So excited for this conversation. And Rob, welcome. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. Before we start the interview, I'm wondering, did you have a favorite TV series when you moved to Memphis at age 11 that you couldn't wait to watch when you got home from school or whatever?
I loved the Bernie Mac show.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And did you like learn things about like Black American culture from that show?
Amazing sense of humor that guy had.
Yeah. It's true. It's true. That's a classic show, too. I have to revisit that show. Thank you for that. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. But I'm never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey. So today, Hun, like I said, we're talking to Rob Cabrera. I'm going to tell you about him. Rob is a native of Rwanda, where he and his family lived through the 1994 Rwandan genocide. He and his family spent 6 years in refugee camps, and he was 11 when they were resettled in Memphis, Tennessee, here in the States. After Stanford, Robert founded alternative credit rating agency CreditMarks with the objective of helping to extend credit into traditionally underserved markets, aka poor people. Robert has helped over 50 energy companies in 9 countries provide clean tech to 6,000 people living off the electricity grid. Rob is the co-founder of and COO of Sync Energy AI, a no-code energy analytics software company. More recently, he was added to the 2018 Global U.S. Forbes Under 30 list in the energy sector, which is so cool. So impressive, right, hon?
And that explains why he was so patient during the setup.
Yes, yes, he was so patient.
Uh-huh. We were struggling.
We were struggling, but we got it all together. Mm-hmm. So, Rob, I always ask our guests when they start, how do you identify?
I identify, believe it or not, as a universal citizen.
Yes.
Since surviving the genocide, I have no real roots to Rwanda, which has opened up sort of the universe. So I have no allegiance to any one location. My allegiance is mainly to my cause, which has been access to energy.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you for that. So you were born in Rwanda in 1988, right? And you're the youngest of 7?
That's correct.
So can you briefly, I don't want to take a lot of time with this, but I really want to know if you'll repeat that history lesson that you gave to me on the 1994 Civil War over cows, I believe it was.
Absolutely. This is, we'll make it a 30-second crash course on the history of Rwanda. Rwanda is a country located in East Africa. It's known for, if you know Jane Goodall and the lowland gorillas, that's where they are from. Very hilly. And during colonial times in the early 1800s, when Germany first came, they wanted a way to rule most of the land but deal with few people. And they realized that in that society, having cows was a sign of wealth. But there were two tribes of people. The nomadics that depended on cows, who were the minority, like 5% of the population. Then there was those that lived off the land who were Hutus and Tutsis. So that's where this Hutu and Tutsi idea came from. It has nothing to do with physical attributes. It has everything to do with your way of life. If you're Tutsi, you depend on cows. If you're Hutu, you depend on the land.
Mm.
Fast forward 100 years later, when the Belgians came to Rwanda in the early 1950s, they said, hey, this doesn't make sense. Why are a few people in charge of the many? So they put the Hutus in charge and kicked out the Tutsis. And what we saw as the genocide in 1994 was those people that were kicked out in 1959 coming back to reclaim what was theirs.
Wow, that was so succinct and so informative. Thank you so much. You're so thoughtful. I love the way you talk. Everything that you say feels like it could be, you know, given from the podium of a classroom or a college auditorium. But thank you for that. So now I want to go to, you told me that you have a memory of your mom cooking and then hearing that the president was shot. Is that correct?
Yes. So people ask about the war and how it happened. It wasn't anything gradual. It happened overnight, whereby it was literally Wednesday, April 6, 1994. We're at home in the evening. Mom is cooking in the kitchen. She's a phenomenal chef, always has been. And we're all telling stories, listening to a radio talk show. And around 7:30, 8 p.m., we hear two loud blasts in the distance. And half an hour later, there's an announcement on the radio that the president's plane has been shot down.
Mm.
And they say no one should go out. By midnight, there's gunfire. And that is how the genocide started. Instantly, overnight, none of us were ready for it.
That's incredible. And how old were you then?
I was 5 and a half.
5 and a half. So it wasn't just the president was shot. His plane was shot down.
Yes, his cabinet members were there. And I think the president of Burundi was also with him. They had just come from signing a peace treaty somewhere.
Wow. Wow. So after the plane is shot down, there's basically mayhem, right?
Correct.
Where everything around you erupts in gunfire and probably people trying to get safe, right? Like somehow make themselves and their family safe. What did you guys do after that, your family?
Yes. So the first few days we were in the house in hiding, but we realized that we were not safe there. And so my father had dug a tunnel in the back of the house that he used to keep his equipment in. And at first it was just my family members. But then we had neighbors of the same sort of faith that were in danger of the opposite tribe. And so my dad brought them in to our house for hiding. We ended up being 17 people that spent 22 days in the tunnel.
Okay, so what tribe are you?
I'm mixed. So my parents, my mom is one tribe, my father's the other. But when the war first happened, it was the people opposite the president's tribe that were getting killed. And so some of our neighbors that were of that tribe, he brought them home because he knew that they were going to get killed if he didn't hide them.
Wow. Wow. So this tunnel that your dad built, what kind of equipment did he have that he needed to put in there?
He was a metallurgical engineer, which he would refine raw minerals and rocks and turn them into finished product, like your axle in your car. And so he felt that the safest place to keep them was sort of underground from theft because this was expensive equipment. He had financed from Germany, I think it was.
Amazing. So this wasn't something that he dug then with just a shovel. This was a built tunnel?
He had dug it, I think, over 3 years. So he would bring people from his village to dig it and then take them home. So he didn't use local people because, of course, if you use local people and they found out, they'll probably come and rob us.
Wow. How did you breathe? in the tunnel? Like, where was the oxygen source?
There was little oxygen. So it was an L shape, right? It went down, I think, about 20 feet, and then across maybe another 8 feet or 12 feet. And the top of the tunnel, when we went in, we took in a folding ladder that we stretched to get down. And then after we got down, we sort of folded it next to each other. Mm. And we put plywood to cover the entrance of the tunnel. So much so that eventually when the rebels came to our house and found that our house was locked from the inside, they spent 3 days trying to break into the house.
Oh, wow.
And when they finally did, they were looking around for who was there, and they didn't. So they used our house as their base, and they actually used the entrance of the tunnel as their restroom. And as gross as that was God's answer to our prayers, that they would never suspect we were there, because you never suspect people where you do your business.
Wow. So that was 22 days of you and two or three other families, you said?
Yes.
Hiding in this tunnel that's now built under a latrine pit, right? They're using that for their latrine. What happens when you leave? Why do you leave? Why do you think it's safe to leave? And then what happens when you do leave?
A few times we go up to inspect the situation and things are not good, but finally we run out of food. We took in a few things, some rice, some beans, some sugar. Those things run out. And we decide it's better to die quickly by a bullet than starve to death.
Oh.
And so we finally, when we ran out of food, we went on our knees, said our prayers, and went out. And when we did, the rebel forces, which were the opposite tribe of the president, were controlling the area. And so because my dad had saved several of our neighbors of that tribe, they returned the favor and did all the talking. And because it was their tribesmen talking to them, they were more understanding and courteous. And when we had finally come out, the whole area was desolate. Houses broken, dead bodies everywhere, dogs eating meat, live with dead people. But there was still fighting nearby. And so they told us, literally after 24 hours of leaving the tunnel, that it was no longer safe. And we had to hike 70 kilometers to the safest place. So if you see movies about war, you typically see people carrying their things on their head and hiking. That was that hike. But that hike was, for us, 70 kilometers nonstop in the middle of dead bodies. Sometimes people are getting pulled aside and getting killed because they had political activities. And so we pretty much had to keep moving until we had left the war zone.
75 kilometers, what's that in miles? Do you know, around, roughly?
Maybe 50, if I had to say.
55 miles, so you are 5.5 years old, the youngest of your family, and you have what, like a little bag? Do you have any belongings with you at all?
We had very little belongings because most of this stuff happens very randomly. When I tell people about the experience, they say, oh, did you bring your bag, your emergency kit? There is nothing. When a bullet starts right. flying where you are, you don't have it. You can't even bring your driver's license. You just run for your life. So it was such a situation. But on that walk, my dad jokes about it, which is, he says I was more of a man back then than I am now, because evidently I didn't complain the whole time.
Mm, you were a trooper.
It was hard to complain because as we were walking on the road, you'd see people that would stop and you'd sense a sense of grief and desperation in their families. Or you'd see people that would stop because they were fatigued. And when I saw that, I was like, whatever happens, I'm going to keep my little legs moving. I don't want to be that person because nothing good is going to come from that. So just kept it moving.
Wow. And you had your entire family with you. So that also probably felt fortunate, right? That you were all intact.
Yes.
So Rwanda is teeny. It's a really small country. I mean, I know that a lot of Americans, including myself at times, think of Africa as a monolith. Like, did you go to Africa? Or I went to Africa. People don't even say which country they went to. They just talk about Africa. But Rwanda is teeny. It's between like Tanzania, Botswana, right? It's near there. Congo?
Yeah, it's surrounded by Congo, Uganda, Tanzania. A very tiny country.
Very tiny. And is it up in the hills?
It's called the Land of a Thousand Hills. That's right.
Yeah. So were you walking up and down those hills?
Yes. Some of the places we did go had hills. Yes.
Wow. And then you end up where at your refugee camp? Where is that? What country was that in?
We ended up in several refugee settlements, the first major one being one in the Congo, which mm-hmm. in itself is literally people living in sticks covered by tarp.
Right.
And when it rained, there's mud everywhere. So that place was super less than ideal. And of course, again, the rebels are there and people are getting killed. And we determined we weren't safe there. So that's when we eventually moved to Uganda.
And so at this point, your parents understand that they're not returning to your home where you grew up in, where they had established their family. Do they know they're not returning, or are they waiting to return?
At this time, I think it's a no. You are hoping that the violence is going to end. But as we know, I think the Rwandan violence lasted a good 5 years.
Yeah.
And so my father's objective was to get us as far away from that violence as possible, which is why we ended up tracking through 5 countries all the way down to Botswana. And that's where we spent 3 years in a refugee camp there.
Okay. How old were you when you were resettled to Memphis?
When I resettled to Memphis, I was in 2000, 11 and a half. I wanted to go back and say, my father hiding the neighbors in the tunnel was him essentially signing his death warrant. And that was my first and most important lesson in service leadership. That has inspired everything I've done. Most of my work in energy, in credit scoring, in my current job in predicting disasters of the climate, it's how can I use my gifts in math to help as many people as possible? And I know that because he put everything at risk, but he lived such a happy, fulfilled life ever since then. He never talked about it, but you can tell what he had done in the war gave him a sense of satisfaction. And so that was the earliest and probably most important career lesson I've ever had.
Oh, yeah. To see that at that young of an age and see that selflessness and that self-sacrifice for the good of the whole, for the good of the people, to be willing to, like you said, to die so that others might be saved is very rare. It's rare. It's not something that we see, certainly where we are today in society. But even the stories that came out of times before, those are still rare stories. So your father, you're fortunate to have him as that role model. And I'm sure he's extremely proud of you for carrying it on. Even before we go to where you were in Memphis, when you guys were in that last camp at Botswana, and now your parents have the idea that they're not going back to Rwanda, are you guys looking forward to going to the States? How quickly does that process happen?
Absolutely. And I know one of the themes of your show is starting over and moving on and resilience.
Yes.
And no group of people understand that concept more than immigrants or refugees, because every single country, every single location you go to is the start of a process. And everyone and everything is scheming against you. So it requires a tremendous amount of resilience. And as Scott mentioned at the beginning of this show, we struggled for 15, 20 minutes on how to get this started. But I can tell both of you have a very high level of resilience, because in my opinion, the average American would have been like, yeah, let's just reschedule. And so it's the ability to push through and push through and push through. And to answer your question on how it relates to this topic is, did they know what was going to happen? The answer is no. And so how did that affect your mental state? Mm-hmm. When you have hardships, you can either let those things frustrate you and cause you, there was a lot of people in the camps that were mentally unstable, that were angry. Or you can be grateful for every day because you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And when you do that and you don't take tomorrow for granted and you're very busy appreciating today, I can tell you now, the time in the camp in Botswana was some of the best days of my life, because never once was tomorrow promised. It was a blessing to see the sunrise. It was a blessing to see the sunset. So in between, you made the most of it. So I think people that are whatever demons they're dealing with, I think if you focus on being able to rebuild yourself and make the most of the day, the hour, the minute, you realize that there's a saying, right? That there's two ways to view time. When days are long and years are short, or when days are short and years are long. And you're typically happier when your days are long and your years are short because you have more memories. And you do that by being grateful and focusing in the here and the now.
Wow. That is a life lesson for sure. It's a lot of the way that Scott and I have dedicated ourselves to living, which is one day at a time, but that's even broad. We really live moment by moment. It's important to us that we don't spend too much time worrying about what tomorrow brings. And I think because of that, we can really enjoy our lives. They're pretty fantastic. And we're at the stage in our lives where we can enjoy just being with each other too, which is nice. But I love that. I love what you said. So when you did find out that you were going to Memphis, was that the day before? Did you have like a week? Did you have any idea what America was like or what Tennessee was like?
We had no idea. The way the process works is while you are a refugee applying for citizenship, they keep you in a camp. And that process can last anywhere from 3 years to decades. And when the country rejects your application, there's 90 days for someone to sponsor you to go somewhere else, or you're deported to where you came from.
Oh.
And the experience of waiting to come to the U.S. was actually a very concerning one because we didn't know whether we were going to go somewhere else or we were going to get backtracked down to step zero. And so when the UNHCR found a sponsor for us, we did not believe it was happening until we landed in New York City, because to fly to the U.S. from Botswana, you first go to Europe and then you go across the Atlantic to New York. And when we were flying from Botswana past Zimbabwe, past Zambia, just past Tanzania, you pass Rwanda before you go north. And that leg of the flight was like, yep, they're definitely taking us back. But then you get to Europe, then you get to the U.S. and you're like, okay, maybe this is a chance at a fresh start.
Right. Wow. So you resettled in Memphis. You go to school there. Are all your siblings school age at that point?
No. So the people that came to the U.S. was me, my two parents, and my three siblings. So the four of us.
Okay.
The others were in other parts, has sort of taken different routes. So it was six of us. And the two older ones tried to apply for college. And so it was me and the girl that I followed that started middle school and high school.
We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
You said that you have your mother's looks and your father's personality, right? Like the perseverance.
That's it.
So tell me, how does a genocide survivor relocate it to the States, go from there to Stanford, and then working with former President Obama? How does that happen? Talk to me about that journey.
So that my path evolved from my experience in the camp. And by that, I mean, when we were in the camps, especially in Botswana, when you are an immigrant in any country, you are not treated very nicely. Mm. The example I give is, look at how we treat people from Mexico and the U.S. Not very nice. And the U.S. is a first world country with a lot of resources. The poorer the country, the worse they treat you. And if you are a refugee, it's even worse. And so in the refugee camp in Botswana, we were treated very badly. Mm. And the only way I had to be able to get even was to do well in the classroom. And so I studied hard, not to pass, but to get even. And I became very, very good at that. And part of my work now stems from, we didn't have access to electricity in the camps. And when I needed to read a book, I read it after dark. It was at night on a kerosene lamp outside. And I remember every time I was reading at night, because Botswana is in the middle of the desert, the Kalahari Desert, the wind would blow the kerosene lamp out. And I remember asking myself two basic questions. Number one, how do we get lights on down here for everyone? Mm-hmm. And number two, how do we keep the lights on so that they don't go off every time, such as this kerosene lamp?
Right.
The answer to that first question was my initial work in East Africa with the 50 companies and 9 countries. My obsession with energy has been from that very night.
Wow.
And then the second question is, how do you keep the lights on? It's what I do now. Mm-hmm. When we have hurricanes and wildfires and snow and ice storms, can we model and predict that stuff before it happens so that people are not in the dark? And that's what I'm doing now. So to answer your question, my drive from the camp to the U.S., to Stanford, to what I do now, it was not so much excellence. It was survival to the extreme.
Incredible. Again, I just have to applaud the thoughtfulness of your answers and how you connect everything. And I'm just thinking about the call that you and I had before this interview. And you were the first person who asked me about me and the podcast and where we started. After I had, you know, finished asking you all my questions, no one's ever done that before. And you weren't asking, like, what's the podcast about in a very general way. You really wanted to know the journey that started it and what was behind it, because you said it was important for you to know the characters of the people that you were going to be conversing with and talking to. And that just blew me away. And it really speaks to who you are now that I'm getting to interview you. I understand. And I also understand your success in this field, because this is what you must bring to your encounters with everyone, is that same kind of thoughtfulness. And like Scott was talking about, that patience, that ability to observe your surroundings and see when and where to engage and how to serve people. When you and I talked, you told me that, could this be right? I have it in my notes that 90% of Africa is not banked. Is that right? Do I have that wrong?
That's correct.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So tell me what that means and why that was a call to action to you.
Yes. So going back to my obsession about how do we bring lights to everyone. When I went, after I graduated in 2011 from Stanford, I worked for a large engineering company for a while. And then I became interested in how can I bring electricity to people living off the grid. And this is when Obama had just done his Power Africa initiative. He got $43 billion to try and electrify Africa. And a chunk of that was for off-grid Africa. It was done by a U.S. agency. And I was like, hey, I know energy. I know Africa. I can speak 6 African languages. This is an opportunity for me to go and do something about it. And when I worked with those 50 energy companies in non-African countries, it became very clear to me that the biggest problem they had was not access to energy or education or health. It was money. Now, the U.S. solved that problem 100 years ago with a FICO score. In America, if you have a good credit, you can have a house, a car, a student loan. And so even if your income is tiny, you can still have access to basic needs. And so when I realized that people on the continent make very little money, it was how do we create a credit system for them to be able to get the resources they need for that solar panel, for that tampon, for their kids to go to school, for that pill for malaria, whatever it is they needed. And so I was interested in how do these people get access to money? And it turned out majority of them do not use bank accounts. They use informal lenders, loan sharks, payday money people, crazy interest rates. And that system was very inefficient. It took weeks, sometimes months. You needed to give up a lot of collateral. And what I did in a very short amount of time was I developed a credit scoring system that allowed people to be credit worthy, to get a loan within minutes, to be able to get the money they needed at an affordable interest rate so that they could get access to that solar panel or whatever else they needed. And that credit mark is actually now being used in 4 countries by 120 teams to lend $2.5 million to 5,000 businesses every week.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yes.
That's incredible. And while you were talking, I was thinking that so many places in our poor areas of town in the inner cities here in America, it's the same.
Right.
It's not banks, but payday money lenders, probably just like loan sharks or individuals loaning money to groups of people at a high interest rate. Can you do that here too? In the inner cities?
We've thought about it, and there are a couple of companies that are doing interesting work in that space. But for me, my drive, the credit scoring was a way to allow those people to have more money to buy more panels. So everything I've done was about how do they get those lights that I didn't have for 6 years in my life.
So for the last, I think it's 4 years you talked about, you've been working on a bank for farmers, right, in Ghana, because you mentioned your work in Ghana. Is that correct?
That's right. So that was another discovery, which was majority of the people that are not banked and therefore do not have electricity are smallholder farmers.
Mm.
Africa has, and I mean the whole continent, something like 500 million smallholder farmers that are not banked. But if you look at farmers, especially cocoa farmers in Ghana, it's a very interesting story, and I'm going to summarize it in 30 seconds. Smallholder farmers, 2 to 3 acres in Ghana and Ivory Coast, grow 70% of the world's cacao. Cacao is the key ingredient to chocolate. Chocolate is a $150 billion industry, and these people are all living on less than a dollar a day, which is obscene. However, demand for chocolate has been growing at 4.5% since 1996. But because these farmers are so poor, their productivity has been going down. They're producing at 10% of what they should.
Mm.
And when I did my credit scoring and I credit scored people, I found out that the farmers, everybody else had default rates of 30, 40, 50%. But the farmers were always paying back their loans. So I became interested as to why. So I moved from the city and I spent time on the farms in the bush. And I realized if you give the farmer time enough, you give him the loan before he plants his crop, you give him time enough to harvest and give it back to you, he is going to pay back the loan 100% of the time. So in theory, every farmer, at least smallholder cocoa farmer, has a perfect FICO score. And they are able, and there's huge demand for their crop, because cacao, the crop itself, is pre-sold more than apple products. So 85% of cocoa is pre-sold before it's even harvested. So they have a market, it's in demand, they're credit worthy, why not bank them? And so the thesis for that project was, let's create a financial institution for these people, because they're the largest population on the continent, and banking them is the single most important way to end poverty for 500 million people in one generation.
Wow. That's actually more than I can wrap my head around right now. But I know that I use cacao in my smoothie every day.
All right, and if we don't have it, she is like lit up.
And
you like chocolate, you like my business.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Oh, yeah. There we go. That's how I can wrap my head around it. I love your business then. I love your business. you're now working in the U.S. on an AI company that predicts disasters, is that right? Weather disasters or natural disasters?
That's correct.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So today, when there is a hurricane on the East Coast, we wait for the hurricane to happen, and then we send crews to assess the damage, and then we send people to fix it. But we have enough data and enough computational power to be able to compute what the risks are going to be beforehand. So we can now know which tree is going to hit which power line, cause how many people to lose power, how many incidents, how many hospitals, how many schools, how many devices are going to go down, and how long all that's going to happen. And we can predict all that information up to 96% accuracy 4 months in advance. So now, when we have crazy weather, whether it's wildfires or hurricanes, if we know it beforehand, we can prevent some of those things. Or if they do happen, we can minimize the damage they have on people.
Mm. What about earthquakes?
We don't specialize on earthquakes because there's a whole bunch of companies that do that. So we specialize in the other four, which is tropical storms, wildfires, snow and ice.
A lot of my family lives in Florida where there's a lot of tropical storms and hurricanes. So that's much appreciated. And Scott's daughter, my bonus daughter, the young one who lives in Vermont, has the snow and ice. So you'll be predicting things for a lot of our family and keeping them safe.
And we are the wildfire state. So
yeah.
And we are the wildfire state. Uh-huh. That's true. Yeah.
I want to sort of tie this to, I think, because I'm sure whoever's listening is like, okay, this guy does great stuff. What does this have to do with me? And long time ago, a mentor of mine in Memphis told me, look, Robert, the meaning of life is to discover your gift. The purpose of life is to give that gift away. And all these things I've done, the energy, the credit scoring, the disaster prediction is risk. I discovered growing up in a war zone, I was very comfortable with the risk. So when things go wrong, people freak out. I'm very comfortable. The trick was, can I find a way to put that risk into math? And so my gift was quantifying risk. And the way I'm trying to give that gift away is anything that's highly uncertain, can I measure it, predict it, so that it can be prevented? So the credit scoring was financial risk. The disaster is weather, natural disaster risk. But it's the same thing. To me, it's from those early days in refugee camps of being in absolute uncertainty. How do you become comfortable with that? How do you put numbers to it and then predict it, so that a lot of people are benefited from that?
Ah, oh, that's beautiful. I love that. And thank you for tying it back to that, because I know that most of what you do now stems from that time in your life, but it does relate to all of us because of that.
I would postulate probably your gift is a combination of resilience and storytelling. And I think your purpose is this show to talk to people and bring out people's resilience so that they can feel better about it and come from this state of just surviving to thriving.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate you for that.
I appreciate you. And I'm going to really take another look at the news when they're showing refugees and the internment camps at the borders and think about, more than I normally do, what it might be like for someone there and how we as a nation are treating them. Because of this talk with you today, that was really eye-opening for me too. The last thing I wanted to talk about before we close is, I don't know if I have this right either, but I wrote down that you said you've been left in charge of your family, which is like 75 people. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so can you tell me about that and why you?
Yeah, so my dad passed away 2 years ago. And in my family, we sort of think of like the godfather. Every time the godfather dies, he has to pick a new head of the family. So for Don Calione, it was Michael. And so I'm sort of in that role. And my extended family is large, and they depend on me for everything, decision-making, small or big. So in my late 20s, it's like, yeah, take over this family and make sure it goes forward. And that was such an amazing experience, because it's one of the key takeaways for that was a lesson in humility. The only way everyone in the family can feel that they can relate to me is if they can talk to me. And the only way they can talk to me, from the four-year-old nephew all the way down to the grown people, is if I'm humble enough to listen to them. And humility has come in handy because if I apply to other parts of my life, for example, in my work, if I am humble enough to ask for help, it's when I'm able to get the most done and really have the greatest amount of sort of progress. And more importantly, I think, broadly speaking, if you are humble enough to put yourself aside and others ahead of you, it's when you're able to accomplish a crazy amount of things. So that role has really allowed me to put myself aside, both in my personal and professional life, and I've been able to be very happy, do a lot more, and just get a lot more accomplished.
How many of them are here in the States, or are they everywhere?
We are everywhere. If I had to say in the U.S., probably 15 to 17
okay.
people here, yes.
Well, it sounds like your father chose the right person for this role. And what a principled life you lead. It's really beautiful to be able to witness that. Tell me where people can find you, Rob.
Absolutely. So I have a website, Robert Cabera, robertkabera.com. And obviously I'm on LinkedIn. They can also find me on there as well.
Beautiful. Gosh, thank you. This was a conversation. I mean, I whittled down my notes so that we would fit in this hour. I could have talked to you for a lot longer. You're a beautiful speaker and your story is incredible. And thank you for coming to tell it on the show.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much for having me and that wonderful.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for Dungeon Masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.